This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We've spent many hours on this program talking about food, exploring various cuisines and what makes food taste good and actually be nutritious. So it may come as a surprise that in the American diet today, there are three principal ingredients: salt, sugar, and fat. And those three ingredients are in nearly everything we consume if we don't make our meals from scratch. They're there because we like them, and they're in our foods because we've come to like them more and more. It's not unlike a closed ecosystem that feeds on itself. We are addicted to salt, sugar, and fat, and none of this is by accident. It is the result of deliberate moves by our food industry, and it's chronicled in the new book by Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Moss, Salt, Sugar, Fat: How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Mr. Moss is also an investigative reporter for the New York Times and joins us from New York to tell us more about this. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
You're very welcome. You won your Pulitzer for explanatory reporting, so this book falls right into your wheelhouse. But you could have explained any number of things other than how the food industry is hooking us on bad stuff. So what got you interested in this in the first place?
I was actually traveling to Iraq in the Middle East, writing about the war and interviewing jihadists, when my editor at the New York Times asked me to look at the processed food industry in New York. A factory in Georgia had allowed its peanuts to be tainted by salmonella. 8 people died, thousands were injured in 43 states. And the closer I looked at it, the more clear it became that as thousands of products were being recalled around the country, that the global food chain had become so complex and beholden to profit that the largest food companies had lost control of their ingredients. And this became even more apparent in the meat industry, which I looked at next, because they were experiencing a surge in outbreaks of deadly E. coli in hamburger. And when I looked at that, it became clear to me that the largest meat processors were buying pieces of cow carcasses from slaughterhouses around the world and mixing and matching them to make the least cost formulations and not doing some obvious things that would help protect the consumer. But over dinner one night in Seattle, one of my most trusted sources in the processed food industry said to me, "Michael, if you want to see another public health crisis afoot, just look at what we're intentionally adding to our products, things on which we have absolute control over." And boy, was he right. I mean, that was 3 years ago, and now the statistics are even more grim. You know, 1 in 3 adults obese clinically, 1 in 5 kids as well, 24 million Americans with type 2 diabetes, the type that can be caused by diet, another 79 million with prediabetes. Even gout is on the surge, and there are estimates that the obesity epidemic is costing upwards of $300 billion every year in extra medical expenses and lost productivity.
And so this is not, because we've had conversations on this program about this in the past, what's going on, because when most of us grew up, we didn't have this number of obese people in our population. Obesity was the exception, not the rule, and it's quickly becoming the rule, and we've had conversations about what's causing this. Why is this happening? What has fundamentally changed about people that suddenly they are eating junk and eating it in vast quantities? And what you're saying and what your book says is it's not their fault.
You know, one thing did happen before we get to the industry. Certainly starting in the 80s, it seems like almost overnight it became socially acceptable to eat anything, anywhere, anytime. And so you started seeing people walking down the street with a big soda and a snack in their hand, or going into business meetings. That played into the snack food industry because it resulted in what scientists call sort of mindless eating, where you're going hand to mouth and not paying attention, and your brain isn't catching up to what you're doing until it's too late and you've overeaten. I mean, that's certainly the public aspect of the obesity crisis. And we all knew before, in general terms, that eating too much of these foods can make you sick. But what we now know is that the process industry itself has been acutely aware of this, even as it was deepening its own reliance on using salt, sugar, fat to sell their products.
You start your book with the tales of a meeting in Minneapolis in 1999 at the corporate headquarters of Pillsbury. And in that meeting were executives from other food processed food companies like Coca-Cola and Nabisco, Procter & Gamble, Nestle, Mars, General Mills. The meeting starts with a damning presentation from someone in the industry about what these companies were doing to American consumers. The meeting was secret, so how did you come to find out about it?
I was fortunate enough to come across a trove of documents, internal records in the food industry. And oddly enough, these records have been collected as a result of the state lawsuits against the tobacco industry. And you can ask, you know, why? How is the tobacco industry relevant to processed food? Well, starting in the 1980s, the largest tobacco manufacturer, Philip Morris, became the largest food manufacturer in North America by acquiring the old General Foods Company and then Kraft. And in these records that were sucked up by this litigation by the states and now being made public are thousands and thousands of pages of memos and strategy papers and plotting and scheming and planning by the food divisions of Philip Morris. And I was able to sift through those, and it was an incredible eye-opener. That helped me to convince key insiders in these companies to talk to me and reveal even more secrets. Wow. And one of the first things that came out was this 1999 meeting. People have asked me if I'm finding a conspiracy on the part of the food industry. And in this case, this was a conspiracy, but it's not what you think, and it's totally surprising. This rare gathering of CEOs who are, you know, normally fighting each other for space in the grocery store was brought together by none other than a cabal of insiders led by a top executive at Kraft, who had become in the previous year or two deeply concerned about the then emerging obesity problem. He had gathered these CEOs and he laid at their feet responsibility in large part for the obesity situation and other health ills. It was an extraordinary presentation. And he went further to plead with them to collectively start doing something to turn the corner.
And let's be clear about this. This gentleman, is this Michael Mudd you're talking about here?
Yes.
He's the vice president of Kraft at the time. Was he genuinely concerned about the health of consumers consuming the products that Kraft and these other companies made, or was he more concerned about liability issues?
It was a combination. He was genuinely concerned, and he was also looking at this and certainly arguing to the CEOs from a dollars and cents perspective that they were risking losing the public trust, which is enormous. I mean,
yes.
When we walk into the grocery store, and this is true for me today as it was before I reported this book, there's a certain deep trust that goes into your shopping. We go to the grocery store to find food that makes us healthy and strong. And I think this is one of the issues that Mr. Mudd was driving at with the CEOs. You know, forget about the health implications. Just if you just want to think about, you know, dollars and cents, I still think this is the way to go.
Yeah, you make a good point. When you walk in, we've all grown up. Certainly those of us of a certain age, we've all grown up with advertising from companies like Kraft and Pillsbury and Nabisco and Kellogg's and General Mills. And we generally think of these people as having our best interests at heart, making foods that we like, foods that we look forward to eating, comfort foods, things like that. And I would think that we all just think, well, they make these products, they're good for us. The television advertising says they're good for us. Everybody has a smile on their face. And in fact, they're not.
You know, it's a collective problem again. And, you know, the companies make a very convincing argument that they never intended to make the country obese or otherwise ill. But that said, it's now clear that they put so much effort into these three pillars, salt, sugar, fat. They're their holy grail on which they survive. And they know when they hit the perfect amounts of those three ingredients, they'll send us over the moon. Their products will fly off the shelves. We'll buy more. We'll eat more. And they, being companies, they will make more money. And we have to remember, and I think it's wrong to paint the industry as these evil empires. They're companies, and they do what companies do. And I think it would be wrong to expect them, very much of them, to do anything but that.
Michael Moss's book is called Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Michael Moss is our guest, the author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the New York Times. You say that the processed food companies set out to create products that would be convenient and inexpensive, products that the more we ate them, the more we'd want. And obviously, they did that for profit and for shareholder reasons, and I guess they wanted to make food that people wanted, so that's a good point in their favor, I suppose. But did they set out to make us fat? Did they set out to make us addicted, to actually change our tastes?
They argue, again, convincingly, that they didn't intend to make us fat. That wouldn't be in their economic interest. And there's no word that the industry hates more than the A word, addiction. And they make some valid arguments that food cravings don't meet some of the technical thresholds of addiction as it applies to narcotics. They prefer words like alluring, craveable, utterly tempting.
Well, there's that old commercial that says, I bet you, Jake, you can't just eat one. And I think it was a potato chip, and it's true. You can't.
That is so telling in so many ways, and that sort of illustrates how smart Madison Avenue can be in creating slogans. I mean, that was before we really understood what was going into the potato chip formulation and marketing-wise, but the ad guys on Madison totally got it and came up with that. I'd actually talked to the people who were present when that slogan was pulled out of thin air, and the beauty of it was there's total truth behind it.
Yeah. And you talk about, and I wasn't going to talk about this, but I will, but you talk about in the book about all of the research that goes into developing these products, right down to the fact that they know that it's 4 pounds per square inch, I think you said. That's where we want, that's the pressure that we want for a potato chip to break in our mouth at, 4 pounds per square inch. I mean, that seems like a ridiculously detailed understanding of our liking of potato chips.
Well, snack companies will have machines that mimic the mouth, and so they know precisely how to get to that 4 pound limit as well. But yeah, no, incredible amount. I mean, with sugar, we can talk about it. I spent time with a legend in the industry, a food scientist named Howard Moskowitz, trained in experimental psychology at Harvard. He walked me through his recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper, which was battling in third place against Coca-Cola and PepsiCo, to get to a flavor that he knew would be a sure hit. Dr. Moskowitz, came up with 61 separate formulations of sweetness, each slightly varying from the other. He subjected those to more than 3,000 consumer tastings, then took all the data and dumped it into his computer and did his high math of regression analysis and came up with the most perfect formula that hit what he helped coin the term the bliss point for sugar, which is the perfect amount of sugar that will send us over the moon. And he explained to me, it's sort of like a bell-shaped curve that you will see in classroom grading for school kids, upside down U, if you will. And your listeners can do this experiment. If they like sugar in their coffee, take the black coffee, keep adding sugar till you like it the most, and then keep adding more sugar, and eventually you'll go, yuck, this is awful. Mm-hmm. Our love, our craving for sugar is not limitless, and the companies know that they need to hit the perfect amount, and thus they coin it's at the top of that curve. And a little bit too much or a little bit too less will hurt sales. And so every company has a master scientist on board who knows how to hit the bliss point in their formulations.
And what's wrong with that? Because you talk about the product optimization and finding the most perfect version or versions of products in terms of how they taste and how they feel in the mouth, how they smell, how they look on the shelf. Is that a bad thing?
Well, from the company perspective, absolutely not. I mean, it's making their products utterly resistible. If you're walking in the grocery store, though, and you're trying to maintain a diet and maintain your weight and health, the issue with that is, can I resist that product? Can I just drink one can of soda a day or a week, or will I be overwhelmed by this utter appeal, this allure, this attraction? And I think that's one of the issues. And the companies themselves have begun to realize that whether it's subliminal or not, they've worked so hard to make their products attractive that, yes, collectively they've contributed to the obesity issue.
Well, clearly there are people who can resist this. I've only seen your I've only seen your headshot. I don't know what you look like below the shoulders, but it looks like from your headshot that you've been able to resist this. Other people have. Why is it that some people can eat these products, potato chips, Cheetos, hot dogs, breakfast cereals laden with sugar, drink a Pepsi or two, and stop, and others can't?
You know, I don't think we know the answer to that yet. I spent some time with Nora Volkow, the head of the National Institutes on Drug Abuse in the Washington area. She's been there for years and years now. She was a Bush appointee, and she's a scientist and has studied the way the brain reacts to both narcotics and food. And she's convinced that for some people, the most highly palatable, the high sweet, high fat foods are every bit as addictive as some narcotics. And she goes even further to say that, look, if you want to, you know, if you're struggling with food in any way, it's actually a harder fight than it is with narcotics, because you just can't go cold turkey with food. You can't stop eating or you will perish. And you're bombarded constantly by the marketing and the advertising and the pitches and the food itself. Unlike narcotics, where there's a drug dealer off someplace in your world that you have to go visit, food is everywhere. And she's become deeply empathetic with those people who are most hooked on the foods that we all hate to love. I think for the rest of us, it's a sliding scale depending on what else is going on in our lives. I mean, there are times when I can't resist and only eat a serving. Potato chips are the thing that I love. And depending on how much stress is in my life will guide me on how much I pig out on those foods.
Yeah. Coca-Cola calls some of their most loyal customers heavy users. And that's a drug term, isn't it?
I spent time with and profile Jeffrey Dunn, the former president of Coca-Cola for North America and Latin America. He was one of the company's top and most fiercest warriors. He worked there for 20 years. He was fully familiar with their targeting of kids, with their invention of kind of the Super Size Me phenomena. And he explained to me that their best customers were not referred to as consumers or customers, but as heavy users. And there's an equation that goes 20% of the Coca-Cola drinkers will drink 80% of the Coca-Cola. And it became evident to Coca-Cola that it was more cost effective to target much of their marketing at those 20% to maintain or increase their consumption levels, rather than try to, you know, nudge up the 80% of the rest of us who drink only 20% of the Coke.
Talking about Coke reminds me of New Coke. New Coke came out, I guess it was in the 80s, ostensibly because it was going to be better, and it was a major bomb. But what I really understand the reason behind that was that Coca-Cola, the parent company, had a deal with all of the bottlers around the country that they would never increase the price of the formula as long as the formula stayed the same. So they had to change the formula in order to rid themselves of their dependence on sugar and move toward high fructose corn syrup, which was cheaper. That may not be true, but that's what I understand it to be. and we've talked a lot about high fructose corn syrup on this program versus sugar. Is there any difference? Did you look into that at all? Because do food companies lean toward using high fructose corn syrup because it's cheaper or easier to incorporate, or because it's more addictive, or because simply it's cheaper?
I hadn't heard that about Coke and New Coke, and I talk about that in a different way in the book. We can mention, but sugar is sugar. The sort of top expert nutritionists have convinced me, whether it's table sugar or high fructose corn syrup, or shockingly as this might be to people, you know, fruit juice or even honey. If you're just looking at it from a pure caloric standpoint, they're the same. Where high fructose corn syrup came into play, though, was in the soda industry. It's a liquid, and so it was easier to mix with soda, which was great for them, as opposed to table sugar, which had to be dissolved. And then when it was invented, it was somewhat less expensive than table sugar, and those have evened out a bit over the years, but that drove that totally excited the soda industry and likely drove soda consumption and allowed their prices to remain so low. The new Coke thing to me was so fascinating because everybody makes this thing about the cola wars between Pepsi and Coca-Cola. But their executives actually sort of laugh about that and say, look, you know, this was the most bloodless war we ever had. And one of them even said, you know, if the other company hadn't existed, we would have invented them, because every time they came up with a new marketing strategy or advertisement that even, you know, tried to make us look bad, we all did great. I mean, soda consumption, whether you liked Coca-Cola or Pepsi, just kept going up and up and up. And it was, you know, they weren't fighting each other as much as they were fighting for increased consumption by the public.
Let's talk about when this started to happen. When did this move toward all these additives, salt, sugar, fat, and finding products that reach the perfect bliss point of those three things? When did this begin to happen?
Well, you can go all the way back to the invention of cold cereal. Dr. Kellogg was a health nut. He ran a sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan. He hated sugar and wouldn't let his guests have any. His younger brother, Will, came along, took over the cereal business, and started adding, guess what, sugar. So you could sort of start the clock ticking way back then on the industry recognizing that sugar is one of those magic ingredients on which they rely. Another huge development was at General Foods when the CEO, a marketing genius, invented the phrase convenience foods and drove his scientists to invent as many foods as they possibly could, which would be ultra convenient, such as, for example, Tang, the sugar powdered, you know, look like orange juice product that was invented. You know, that notion that foods could be made more convenient was again hugely reliant on large amounts of salt, sugar, fat, because they're not used just for taste. They're used as preservatives in order to let products stay longer on the shelf. And they're also used as inexpensive additives that allows the industry to avoid using more expensive things like fresh herbs and spices and what have you. So the three pillars, the other three pillars of convenience food, of processed foods, convenience, low cost, along with great taste, are all dependent on heaps of salt, sugar, fat.
But why do you have to add salt, sugar, and fat for preservative purposes when you can, you know, cryogenically seal the package or freeze it or do all kinds of things that we can do now that we couldn't do in the 1800s?
Well, certainly back in those days, that was the way to go with preservation. They generally have just sort of stuck with that formula. And again, that's just sort of so inexpensive to do that. And again, I don't want to understate the importance of the main issue here, which is taste. You want those three things for taste. But in addition to that, you can especially see that with salt. Salt has a number of miracle properties that the industry loves. So again, it acts as a preservative, and it's so cheap, they almost don't even think about it. It's 10 cents a pound. They don't even have to think about wasting it when they're using it in making processed foods. It also, though, covers up and masks these off notes that are inherent in some processed foods, especially in a food that contains meat. When meat is reheated, the fat oxidizes and it gives off this flavor that food scientists compare to wet dog hair. They call it warmed over flavor, or WOF. And the cure for WOF is none other than a little more salt in the product.
And salt also shocks your taste buds.
Well, they call it the flavor burst. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. When on a salty snack, when it's on the outside, it's the first thing that hits your taste buds, races along the neurological channels that Nora Volkow has studied, goes right to the pleasure center of the brain, which sends back signals. Eat more.
We're talking about salt, sugar, and fat. Not only the ingredients that are in the food, but that's the name of Michael Moss's book on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Michael Moss, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, our guest today. His book is called The Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. We are hardwired to like sweet, and I've been told that that's because, as cavemen, things that were sweet in nature generally indicated that they weren't going to kill us. They weren't poisonous. But you say that salt is an acquired taste. Sugar makes us fat. It leads to diabetes, or it can. What does salt do?
I want to get to salt, but I know you're fundraising in Charlotte, Mike, and something just occurred to me, if you don't mind.
No, go right ahead.
I'm a reporter, and as a reporter, there's lots of stuff I can't do to be socially responsible. I can't walk a picket line. I can't endorse political candidates or donate money to their campaigns. But I can give money to public radio, and we do in my family. And when I fail to do it, my wife Eve will get on me. Or when I fail to donate a fair share of money, my wife will say, come on, Michael, you can do better than that. So I wish you well in your fundraising in Charlotte.
I just want to point out that was unsolicited. So.
I commend you for what you're doing. I mean, this is the kind of journalism that, you know, we aspire to at the New York Times.
Well, and, you too can be nonprofit.
Yes, and may well be. That's one of the problems. So thank you. Salt. Mm-hmm. I was really amazed when I spent time with food scientists and nutritionists to understand that unlike sugar, unlike fat, we are not born liking salt. That occurs at about 6 months of age. And what also occurs is that our liking for salt appears to be dramatically shaped by the processed food industry. A research center in Philadelphia full of brilliant scientists called the Monell Center recently did a study where they looked at two groups of kids, and the young kids who were exposed to processed food starting at age 6 months were much more apt by the time they're in preschool to be licking the salt shaker. And as weird as that sounds, I caught my own kid licking the salt shaker when he was about that age in a restaurant, of all things. So that's one point. The other thing is that it's not that hard for us to get off salt. Anybody who's been on a low-sodium diet under doctor's orders because of the links to high blood pressure will tell you that all they have to do is stop eating grocery food or high processed food for 6 weeks, and their liking for salt will become, you know, dramatically lowered until they can no longer go in the grocery store and buy things without going, yuck, too salty.
Yeah.
So we're not born liking salt. We can get off salt, but the industry is inexorably hooked on salt, I discovered, which is just really important to understand why they're between a rock and a hard place here.
Yeah, they wouldn't put this stuff in the food if it didn't do something, because it costs money. Even if salt is cheap, it costs money to put it in the food. And some food companies wanted you to understand just what they're up against in trying to create foods that we will like and that we will eat. And yes, from what you learned, let me ask you, is it possible to create a snack food, a cereal, a lunch meat, a frozen meal, without doctoring it with salt, sugar, and fat, something that we would eat it, rather.
I think it may be possible. I think that some of these same brilliant scientists who invented these icons relying heavily on salt, sugar, fat could now be enlisted to do the opposite and find ways to really meaningfully dial down on those three ingredients. But as of right now, you know, I was invited in by Campbell's Soup, by Kraft, and by Kellogg to taste special versions of their products that they had made for me with much lower amounts of salt. And it was such an eye-opener. Kellogg especially. I went to Battle Creek and they made for me versions of their icons with no salt in it at all. And it was, Mike, the most god-awful experience you can imagine. It was after we toured their private research and development laboratory, we sat down. It was me and their head scientist and the company spokesperson. First, we tried the Cheez-Its crackers, which normally I could eat all day long. Mm-hmm. But without salt, we could not even swallow them. They stuck to the roof of our mouths because the salt adds texture and solubility. We then went to the frozen waffles and popped those in the toaster, and they came out looking and tasting like straw. And the clincher was the cereal. We put it in bowls, added milk. And before I could say anything, I looked at the company spokeswoman. She has this expression of horror on her face, and she manages to swallow, and she says, "Metal. I taste metal." And I go, "Yeah, I do too. What's going on?" And the scientist goes, "Well, look, I mean, you know, salt does have this, you know, miracle ability to mask or blend out some of these off-note flavors that are inherent to processed foods and the minerals and vitamins, and it's not all bad stuff that they're adding, like preservatives. It, you know, you can get these metal tastes." And that was just a real eye-opener.
If you're tasting something that is off, that is repugnant, as that metal taste in a cereal, isn't that a good sign that it's not good for you? And the salt is just covering up the fact that you really shouldn't be eating this stuff. Or am I wrong?
That's a really interesting point, and that thought occurred to me as well. You know, we're seeing a number of companies now publicly touting their efforts to dial down salt, sugar, fat, and or calories a bit. And it's actually very easy for them in the beginning because they were adding so much to start with. But you do have to wonder, and hats off to Kraft, by the way, because Lunchables have been getting better nutritionally. But you do have to wonder if they keep going, you know, what's left of their products and just how healthy and nutritious will the remaining ingredients be if they were truly to take out the salt, sugar, and fat.
And you say that when these companies dial down one ingredient, like reducing the fat, they crank up the others.
That does happen. And one of the sort of dangers in the grocery store is being fooled by the touting on the front of the package. We all know to look at the ingredients and the fine print nutrition box that'll tell you how much, you know, saturated fat and calories and salt and is in the product. But I like to tell people that for me it became really informative to look at the advertising on the front of the package in the big lettering. And when you see something that says low fat, you know, the first thing to do is to beware, because it may in fact be loaded with sugar and or salt and on with the low fat products, especially yogurt. You know, these companies really glommed onto yogurt for the shimmer of health that yogurt has, but most of them are loaded with sugar, some cases as much sugar per serving as ice cream, and even a low-fat yogurt will be that sweet.
Does that also apply to these Greek yogurts that seem to be the rage right now? You should eat Greek yogurt. Don't eat the other stuff. Eat the Greek yogurt. Is the same thing true of that?
Some are unsweetened. Mm-hmm. Some are loaded and very heavy in sugar. It depends on the version.
we've been talking about things like breakfast cereals and snack foods and sodas and things like that, which any reasonable person would expect to be loaded with fat and sugar and salt. The problem here, I think, though, is it's not just confined to those foods. It's confined to things that we think are healthy. You bring up Prego. You write about the second most important ingredient next to tomatoes in Prego spaghetti sauce, which is, I think, one of the most popular canned or jarred spaghetti sauces on the market. The second most important ingredient is sugar. What are some of the other non-snack products that amp up the sugar or the salt or the fat or all three?
It's hard to find sort of one that's not. Bread didn't used to be as sweet as it is now. You can almost sort of walk down every aisle of the grocery store and find sugar especially being used in products. And again, the people at Monell pointed this out to me. One of their scientists sort of referred to it as the exploitation of the biology of the child, especially children crave sugar. Every one of their 10,000 taste buds is just waiting for sugar because it's instant calories to the brain. And over the years, you just started to see products that weren't sweet suddenly became sweet. And it's really hard to fight against that. I've started to sort of play around with making homemade pizza because I found a stone the other day where you can really crank up your oven at home and get a nice crust. But when I make sauce myself without the amounts of sugar that you'll typically find in a pizza sauce, my 8 and 13-year-old look at me like I'm like, you know, go away, Dad. You know, let us do the cooking. They're shaping our palate for that sweet taste, and so that kids are expecting to find sweet taste in all kinds of foods.
That's what I meant in the beginning of the program when I said that they're actually changing our tastes. We like things the way they've made us like things over the years. And Sylvia on Facebook has a question about natural flavors. Natural flavors is appearing now on a lot of different products. Is that connected to the salt, sugar, and fat mix? What exactly are natural flavors? And do we really want natural flavors? Do we want sugar?
Boy, Sylvia, I wish I could answer that. It is a mystery to me still. Natural flavors, you'll see that on the label. They're not required to spell those out. And I think in some cases there, you would look at it and go, I'm not really sure this is natural by some technical definition. But generally, that's just sort of a catch-all term for additives that do just a little bit more tweaking for the company, because there's this wonderful term called satiety that and sensory specific satiety is the term that the industry uses, which means that any product that has sort of one overwhelming flavor to it will be really great to taste initially, but then you get tired of it really fast. Mm. And what these companies do is try to reach a blend. So almost so that the taste disappears. And a few hours later, you're remembering the product. You know you really liked it, but you're not put off by any one ingredient. And I think the flavorings are aimed at creating that kind of a balance.
It isn't just the food companies, you say, who are culpable here. It is the federal government. They have created, you say, an unlevel playing field. So tell me how they've done that.
You know, first comes to subsidies to highly processed foods. You almost find no government subsidies in the fresh fruit and vegetable aisle, where everyone, including the government, tells us we should be spending more time and eating more things. But I mostly walk through the development of cheese. And it starts in the 60s when people began drinking less whole milk in order to avoid saturated fat and calories. They shifted to skim milk. That left the dairy industry with a huge glut of whole milk and milk fat that they extracted from the whole milk to make the skim milk. They began making more butter, ice cream, and cheese. And they made so much cheese that the federal government began buying the surplus cheese. It accumulated, believe it or not, in caves in Missouri because the cooling costs were low, until the early 80s when none other than Ronald Reagan came in and said, this is dumb. We're not going to do this anymore. But Congress, still wanting to subsidize the dairy industry, came up with another idea. It allowed the dairy industry to tax itself and raise tens of millions of dollars every year overseen by the USDA to market cheese, to get us to increase our consumption of cheese. And they did it in two ways. One, they made cheese much more accessible as an additive to home cooking. So now you go to the dairy aisle and it's not just cheese in blocks and slices, it's in bags of cubed and shredded and stringed and tubbed cheese. And then they started adding it to their own products. So frozen pizza, you know, went from having some cheese on the top to having lots of cheese on the top and cheese stuffed into the crust. And you started seeing things like peanut butter cheese crackers. Our consumption of cheese tripled since the 70s to as much as 33 pounds now on average per person. And again, the problem is that the industry's boxed in. They can't make a low-fat cheese. It just doesn't taste very good.
Doesn't feel good in the mouth, which is important, a part of all these snack food products. It's got to feel good. Michael Moss's book is called Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us.